Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We finally got some snow and some freezing temperatures. I actually saw gnats flying around a few weeks ago because it was so warm. We're talking about what happens when the temperature does drop. Where do the bugs go? Now we're talking about the bugs of winter and the disappearing bugs of winter maybe as well. Joining us is entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises, Mark Berman. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
You wanted to talk about the disappearing bugs.
The insect apocalypse.
And we have talked briefly over in the past year, I know, about there aren't as many on the windshields anymore, and most people celebrate that, but you say that it's a lot more serious issue, and the New York Times wrote about it last month.
Well, that was how it first started being recognized, was by people just, and people who pay attention to things like that, just noticing that they're just, and the article that I shared with you starts off with a researcher riding his bicycle through the field, you know, on roads through open fields with his son, and neither of them were eating bugs like he always did when he rode his bicycle when he was a kid, and it started making him think. And so he is in the Netherlands, and he and a bunch of other people started putting big, huge nets on top of their cars and driving around with these big nets that funnel into a little container on the end so that they could get some kind of measure of what's going on with flying bugs especially. And you asked earlier whether or not it's all in Europe or if it's here, too. And it started off being reported in Europe because that was here's the problem with it. Finding data that supports whether or not bugs are disappearing is really challenging to do. You see bugs all over the place.
Right.
And so you think, there's bugs all over
December,
the place.
In December, I saw gnats flying around.
Right. I call them fairy bugs. But
right,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
When they're out, there's little ones that go like that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And those are little fairy bugs. But yeah, actually through January, I was seeing them out in the field until just this recent little cold snap. And it's going to warm back up in a couple weeks probably, and they'll be back again. And ever since I've been coming on here, every time I'm here, we talk about what a weird winter it was and what a strange spring it was.
Yeah.
And the weather is just doing crazy things. And this year, this is the first time it's really gotten cold here this year. And it's almost halfway through winter already. And so that matters. But in Germany, there are longitudinal data, which are data that are taken over the years. You know, monarch butterflies were one of the first species people noticed. And honeybees. And one of the reasons that people notice those is because they watch it, and they've been watching it for years and years and years and years.
Because we like our honey and we think monarchs are pretty.
Right. But as importantly as that is that people have been collecting data on them for years and years and years and years. Now, when I was in college in the 80s, I studied monarch butterflies, but I didn't collect data on abundance or, you know, local population sizes or anything like that. And so my data don't help in terms of what's going on with bugs now. And it's really hard to find data sets from long enough ago that are consistently collected enough to be able to make any kind of a legitimate scientific claim that something's happening.
But you're saying in Germany they did?
In Germany, they've had data from – that was taken mostly by – and they apparently don't like it when you call them amateurs, but through an enthusiast group. I don't remember the name of it. But they were out in the field all the time collecting all kinds of stuff years and years and years. And they use these kind of traps called malaise traps, which are like really big tents that have sort of a wall in the back of them that funnels all the bugs up into a little container, sort of like on top of the cars that they were doing. And they've used the same traps in the same places the same amount of times, and they've sort of controlled over the years. But they were just doing it to make collections and stuff. But what it did was it gave them baseline data to have a longitudinal accounting of what's going on. There's not much of that. And of the data that are like that, people don't really think about it in those terms. So now all these people are going back and looking through all these old data sets. And I'm predicting that in the next few months, maybe by summer, we hear a lot more stories of bugs disappearing. Also, in that New York Times article, they mention here, I'll give you some data. In that New York Times article, they mention that they also mentioned another place in Puerto Rico where they had, it isn't exactly longitudinal data, but someone who was studying lizards there in the 70s, collected a bunch of data on bugs, and then they went back in the 2000, like around 2010, and collected the same data on bugs and found a huge dramatic difference that I have written down here somewhere. But that's not exactly the same thing as collecting over time, so you can see it could just be a bad season.
A blip, right.
Yeah, and you never know. And because of the way bug populations fluctuate and they're so sensitive to environmental conditions, it's hard to get a grasp on it. And you can't publish, I haven't cleaned my windshield all summer. You can't publish that, so you need actual
data. That's called anecdotal evidence.
Right, you need, and I was going to ask you, you mentioned earlier that you drive, and you haven't done it.
Well, we've talked about it, that it seems like there aren't as many bugs on the windshield, and we travel long distances in the summer, and my recollection is I don't think we have to stop.
I did once this year, and I didn't really need to, and I'm out there driving around in the
looking for dusk.
And I'm out there driving around all the time, and I really, really noticed it this year. And also out in the field, I noticed it this year, that when you walk along the side of big goldenrod fields, usually there's just all kinds of stuff jumping into the fields
and
flying, and it just wasn't there this year. And when I started thinking about it also and started thinking back, I've noticed it before, but it just didn't it's the kind of thing that there's just so many bugs, it just doesn't register.
And even with an entomologist. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about disappearing bugs today. We're going to also be talking about some pretty unusual bugs. My guest is Mark Berman. He's an entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises. He's a regular guest on All Sides. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So they have found in these longitudinal studies in Germany that there is. The question is, can we extrapolate that to the rest of the country or the world?
Well, those studies found in nature preserves that, let's see, I don't even know what I'm writing here, 76% decrease in biomass from 1989 to 2016.
What does that mean?
Well, they measure biomass because they make these collections in these malaise traps of just myriad tons of flying bugs, and it's really hard to ID each little one. And so what they would do is just measure their weight in alcohol in a standardized way, so that they get a measure of just how much they weigh. You know, basically just how much bugs are there.
Yeah.
And there's no real discrimination on different species or diversity or anything like that. And those are the kind of data they were collecting. And they found a 76% reduction in the actual just amount of flying stuff around over that 30 years. And so let's see what else. Monarch butterflies, they were one of the first ones, 90% decline in 20 years. That's 900 million individuals, fewer now than there were 20 years ago at the overwintering sites. And one of the weird things about it is that this year, I was out in the field all summer, and there were, I don't know if you noticed or not, but there were monarchs everywhere.
I noticed a lot more monarchs this year.
It was a huge monarch year, bigger than I can remember in a long time.
Yeah, me too.
I haven't heard word from the Mexican overwintering sites yet to find out if that translated to the migrating populations. But a lot of – it's so hard to suss out what's going on because so many people have taken to raising caterpillars in captivity. And we talked about this before and releasing them. And I have my own personal passions about why that's just a horrible thing to do. But – it would also artificially increase just the populations around here temporarily.
But a lot of people are also growing more
milkweed.
Milkweed.
Right. And, you know, that's another thing. These things are
but
so complicated.
There can't be enough milkweed to make up for the loss.
Go walk around some of the metro parks around here. There are huge stands of milkweed that are completely untouched.
Yeah.
And even in other fields, I mean, there's a lot of milkweed around that doesn't seem like it's getting decimated like you would anticipate if that was the actual issue.
Yeah.
Monarchs in the world aren't in that much trouble. They're a cosmopolitan species that has, they're all over the place. But that migration down to Mexico is potentially in trouble, but it's so complex, and there are so many different places where it could be. Somebody said fire ants in Texas are eating all the eggs when they break migration and start laying eggs in Texas. And so it's just really hard to figure out what factors are causing something like that. But there's been a concomitant decline in the rusty patched bumblebee. A Facebook friend of mine, Clay Bolt, has been studying these for a long time. Common in 28 states previously, and there's been an 87% decline in those guys in the same amount of time. You take one species, you take monarchs, you take that, you take honeybees, and all of those put together a little bit of a picture, but you really need good longitudinal data to figure it out.
So is anybody starting to collect that now? Or?
Well, that the research from Germany was like the first, that's what inspired this whole issue to hit the press. And so now other people are going back and looking at their old data sets because there's museums and enthusiasts all over the place with tons. But a lot of times it's focused on a species or they make a collection. And so you really have to dig into some big collections of bugs or big sets of data to really figure it out. It's a challenging issue, and we're right at the very beginning of it. And so there isn't a whole lot of data to support it, except you didn't have to clean your windshield this year.
Yeah.
Neither did I.
Yeah. Anybody else out there notice a difference in the number of bugs, the amount of bugs? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kevin, in Columbus, you're on the air with Mark Berman. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Ann and Mark.
Hi,
we had an issue with grubs last year in our grass. We heard it was the perfect storm. It was wet early, then it got dry, and the grubs just thrived. So I treated it last year, but this year I'm looking for something that might be more natural. I mean, the stuff we put down, it looked like it killed just about everything, which is pretty sad. So is there a way to prevent grubs more naturally?
Well, it's a difficult problem, and I don't know, were they like in open areas or were they under the grass or sort of in the garden?
Yeah, they were under the grass and it just browned out. You could dig up and the white grubs were there. Yes.
You know what? I do not have a better answer than some sort of chemical application. And so I can look into it though and let you know. I can post something on Ann's site later, but
I mean, the idea is if you don't want to kill them, is there a way to distract them and move them elsewhere? And I just, short of killing them with pesticides, and we really don't want to focus the whole show on how to kill bugs, but Kevin, your thoughtfulness is appreciated.
Yeah, well, it's obviously a big challenging problem. What I recommend is getting rid of your lawn and growing a natural yard that has native plants and, you know, prairie plants and things that live around here. And then you won't have things that are out of balance. And also the things that are out there belong there and you'll appreciate them instead of hate them for destroying your yard. But I'm not the only one who thinks that grass yards are one of the worst European ideas that has ever come around. It's just totally unnatural. So you would expect there to be problems that are hard to fix. And so off the top of my head, I don't know what to tell you, but I can look it up and try and find out.
Okay. Kevin, thanks a lot for that call.
I was going to say something else before we go too much deeper into other stuff about this whole apocalypse thing. One of the other big problems about it is that it was a banner year for monarchs this year. Yeah. So I go out in the field and I see monarchs everywhere. And it just took me till near the end of the year before I started noticing there wasn't a whole bunch of other stuff. And then currently in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia, there's a huge locust outbreak. And so you go there and there's grasshoppers flying through the air and you can't, they smack into you and you can't, it's like a huge, it's like a plague. From the Bible, locusts were one of the plagues in the Bible. And so even though there's this eerie overall decline in general numbers, there's these other issues like locust plagues and butterflies all over the place and stuff that makes you think nothing's really happening. And so that's why you need data to figure this stuff out.
We're going to continue our conversation. My guest is Mark Berman, entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises. You want to talk about bugs, not killing them? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about bugs today with entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises, Mark Berman. If you have a question or comment about bugs, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's not a lot. How much does it affect our ability to study bugs when we can only do it seasonally? They're not around that, you know, all year round.
Right. That's the one of the first, excuse me, if you've heard about the 17-year cicadas that only come up every 17 years.
Yeah.
I met a researcher in Hawaii back in the 80s who studied those. And every year she would go to a different place in the Midwest to find out where they were coming up. But that's one of the big problems with studying bugs is that it's seasonal, and also that it's so misleading. On the break, we were talking about the locust swarms in Mecca, and there's an unbelievable number of bugs flying around in the air, 150 million in a kilometer squared. Each one eats as much as 2,500 people. They are a huge pestilence. Also, there's other cases where there's just so many bugs in one place where there's these big outbreaks, and you're like, how can there be a problem with bugs? And so that's another big problem with the whole issue is that sometimes there's huge abundance and then sometimes there's not. And so it's difficult. You have to get the right kind of data sets to get a handle on it. It's really tough.
This year, can we still, if we have freezing temperatures, how much of a cold winter do we need to have things be normal? Is it too late?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's too late or not, but if we don't have so considering issues like that and considering issues like this huge rapid decline in insects, it could be due to sort of two different things that we're doing. It could be due to climate change, right? Because they're so carefully tuned to their environment mm-hmm. that minor change, a couple degrees is a big, huge difference in their life histories. They can't live where they live, which means they'll probably move. And when all the climate change dust has settled, things will just be in a different place than they were before. And some things will die out and other things will benefit from it. But the other factor could just be that we're just poisoning the place and killing we're destroying habitats. And if it's a result of sort of that kind of applied push that we're putting on them, then I don't know how anything recovers. I mean, that's a whole different endpoint scenario than if just the climate is changing quickly over time. And so on a winter like this, I mean, if things are going to return to normal, I don't know what normal is, but a mild winter where fairy bugs and gnats are flying around in January just changes what's going to happen in the spring and the summer. For better or worse, you don't know. But, you know, if we have a winter like they have in North Carolina or something like that, we're going to start having plants and animals like they have in North Carolina. Because they're just going to go to where they can survive. So I don't know. I want to know that monarch butterfly overwintering counts in Mexico, because there were two other things I mentioned to you in our notes was that they just recently discovered that up to 40% of the Midwestern migrants end up in Florida.
But the point was that before we thought it was a stop along the way.
What, Florida?
Yeah. And now it's being concluded that it could be a destination.
Well, in Florida actually has resident populations that do little mini migrations up and down the state and stay in Florida.
Because it's so warm, right.
But I don't think it was ever really assumed that a lot of the bugs from – or the monarchs from the Midwest ended up in Florida.
No.
And they may or may not have gone through, but usually the maps you see showing where they go, they just go straight down.
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for them to go from
Florida and
here
then jump
to
over
go
to –
yeah, it's
Mexico,
not like the airlines where they got to do the right fares or anything. they would go sort of follow the winds, yeah. you know, and go in a straight line as yeah. fast as they can. But with the numbers being way down in Mexico, and now they found this year there was an 86% decline in the monarch butterflies in California. You know, the way the migration splits up is the Rocky Mountains. Everything east of the Rockies goes to Mexico. Everything west of the Rockies goes to the coast in California. And there's been an 86% decline this season in the monarchs in California. And so that particular smaller migration is also supposed to be challenged. And it's a really delicate system. And so it's hard to say what's going to happen.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Mark Berman, entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises. We'll have a link to his website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. And Ed in St. Clairsville, you're on the air. Hi, Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi. What I'm calling about is I had said that I had noticed about 3 years ago in East Ohio, we had a tentworm outbreak that was really bad. Trees were just getting covered in the spring and the early summer with tentworms eating the leaves and killing off a lot of the trees. And then 3 years ago in the spring, they just started dying off. And it's been 3 years now. I haven't seen any tentworms at all in East Ohio. And I just wondered if that had been reported anywhere else. I did some research online, and I couldn't find anything, but the tentworms in, like, East Ohio just disappeared and they're gone.
I don't see as many of those either. I mean, there used to be a spot in my morning walk with my dog where I would see them a lot. Is there something going on there, Mark?
Okay, well, first of all, a couple of things that Ed had mentioned was when he said they were killing off all the trees, I would bet that if you go back to that place again, the trees aren't killed off
right.
at all. That's called pruning. And almost every tree out in nature, under normal circumstances, has about 1,000 caterpillars living in it that we never see. And if they weren't there, then the leaves would just, I don't even know what would happen. The tree would grow out its leaves and the leaves would get old and tired.
Dry and
yeah. And so the caterpillars provide a very important Native caterpillars provide a very important service for native trees and native forests. As far as the tent caterpillars go, there's two main species that live here. There's the eastern tent caterpillar, which makes its web in the crotch of trees uh-huh. in the spring. And then there's the fall webworm that usually shows up. They've got two generations, so they show up about midsummer and then late summer or early fall. And they wrap their webs around the end of branches.
Okay.
So it's more
they're
like a bag.
Two different kinds.
Yeah, there's
gotcha.
Two different kinds. And them disappearing doesn't surprise me under the circumstances. Everything's disappearing. And so the fact that Ed was – see, that's the kind of data you have.
Yeah.
You have those anecdotal, I'm not cleaning my windshield. I don't
yep.
see the tent caterpillars
right,
anymore.
Right.
And until there's actual data, it's going to be really hard to mm-hmm. sort of put any firm conclusions on any of this. And so I don't know. I agree. There weren't that many around this summer.
Yeah.
And
I
don't know, but Ed's right on, he's right on top of noticing what's going on.
Right. Ed, thanks for that call. Betty in Columbus, you're on the air with Mark Berman. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in Upper Arlington, Columbus, and where we all have lawn.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided this year to let some of my lawn go natural
mm-hmm.
just by throwing out some prairie plants. And it was great.
Right.
And not, I mean, they did great. The lawn didn't do very well before growing grass, but now it grows these beautiful prairie plants, quite assortment of them. And the bugs we had this year was so much fun to see all the different bugs come. So I recommend that other people do the same thing. But we kind of need to change the laws of some of the local communities to allow these.
Right. No question.
Yeah.
The laws and the attitudes. And great for you to do that. Aside from everything else, it's just easier because you don't have to mow the lawn and pull the weeds and everything all mm-hmm. the time. But I try to convince people often about their gardens and how you plant natives and you get a lot more than just pretty flowers that sit there and you can say, ooh, look at the pretty flowers.
Mm-hmm.
You get pretty cool stuff doing things with the flowers.
It, yeah.
And so good for you, because that's a great trend. And you're absolutely right, especially when you live in, you know, like gated communities and things like that. They have big, huge problems with people letting their lawns go, and neighbors have big, huge problems with people letting their lawns go.
There are deed restrictions and things like that. You can't.
Right. And so it's like this system that's just built to destroy the system we're living in. And it's a big problem. And so I think that Betty should make a lot of noise about it and convince all her neighbors that that's the way to go. And then pretty soon they'll change the attitudes and rules about it. But a lot more people are doing that. And when you drive around, especially some of those communities like in Clintonville and
Worthington,
and you'll see people's yards that look gorgeous and there's no grass whatsoever.
Right. Betty, thanks a lot for that. You have a little guy.
I know,
up
I got
here.
This out to tease you.
It's so cute.
I told you I had some of the most amazing bugs you'll ever
see.
Yeah,
this is, I don't know if they can see it.
I'm going to put it down here so I can walk around. Yeah. Now, you tell me how cool a bug has to be.
It's kind of like a walking stick with nabby knees. No, like a, what is it?
Let me give it a branch to walk on.
I noticed there are no tarantulas today, so
I'm all chill today. I pulled it off the plant so that you could see
it
better.
Yeah, it's very cool. But what is that, a walking, right. No, is that a...
This is a mantis. I'm going to stand up here and show it to you. This is called a wandering...
I can see it. I'm just going to... What, you want me to touch it? Of course you do. Okay. And it's just, it's the cutest little guy.
That's called a wandering violin mantis. And if you look at where its head is, and then you look at where its abdomen is, its food has to go down that little tube to get to its abdomen.
That's something, I'll tell you. And it looks like a tiny little stick. And it's got a little scorpion-like tail on it.
Now,
I assume it won't sting me.
No, a lot of mantises, when they're young, they'll curl their abdomen up like that to help break up
the
shape.
Well, that's the abdomen. Okay, gotcha.
When it grows up, it's going to get wings and its abdomen will be flat. But a lot of times when they're young, they'll curl their tail up like that, and that just helps the deception.
I don't know. Can they see us? I don't know. It's kind of cute. Do you actually name these dudes?
They don't come when you call them.
They don't come when you call them. It's so cool.
This one is...
very, very sweet.
This one is called Gongolides Gongolides.
And it's not from here.
No, it's from Sri Lanka and India. I had to look it up because I knew you were going to ask. It is not from... No.
This is not from here.
I'll show you another example,
really
though.
Cool.
I'll show you another example of how they curl their tail, though. Or how they curl their abdomen, because this is an adult.
This is another praying mantis.
Uh-huh. And this is an adult Indian flower mantis.
And this looks... Oh, just grab it. Okay. So this looks like it has bugs all over. Oh, my gosh. Look at that. The top of it looks like it has an eye.
And it has pink eyes. Yeah. And it's called, sometimes called a number nine mantis, because it looks like it has a number nine on its back.
It's really cool looking.
And look at its eyes if you can.
It's very busy. And its eyes are... Yep, they're pink. And they're bulging. And it's got a spotted antennae. And it's got like a nine or like a swirly on the back of it. It's very cool. Super cool.
And when it was a
he's
baby.
He's bombarding me with mantis.
No, now. When it was a baby, it looked like this.
Oh, and there's a baby. It looks like a squirrel. A bug, a squirrel bug. Yeah, it's very
But again,
fluffy.
You can see how it turns its abdomen up.
Yeah.
And the underside
of
its abdomen is all spiked. And so if it's sitting in a flower, that blends in perfectly with a flower. You could imagine if it was in a goldenrod or something.
There's a grown-up and a baby. Very different.
I know,
very
it's hard to see him on the radio, but...
Well, you know, there is the magic of the internet. We'll try to... hopefully, you know, folks, if you want, you can watch on the internet. And little Nabby Knees here, down here, is just behaving very, very well.
Oh, I forgot I had that on.
Yeah, I never forget. I'm going to let Mark fiddle with his... praying mantis. Do you call them manti or mantises?
The family name is mantidae, M-A-N-T-I-D-A-E. And so the official plural is mantids.
Mantids.
T-I-D-S.
Okay. All right. Praying mantids galore. here in the studio. My guest is entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises, Mark Berman. If you have a question or comment, we're going to get to those calls, so stay with us, and we're going to get to some emails as well. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can call us at 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about bugs today with my guest, Mark Berman. He's an entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational and Science Shows.
Yeah, we changed it to Bugman Education and Science Shows.
Okay, good to know.
Well, you know,
anyways,
we'll
have a link on our website at wosu.org/all sides.
It's bugs.org. But when I first started this, I called it Bugman Enterprises.
Which was
dumb
cute.
Because everybody misspells it or
right.
mispronounces it and says enterprises. Don't
yeah.
make up a word when you start your business. So then
yeah.
we changed it to Bugman Educational Enterprises because that was BEE. And I was going to make a second little mascot, Bumblebee, to go along with our PR mantis.
That's getting complimented.
And then it was BEE. So then I just changed it to Bugman Education. And then I changed it to Bugman Education and Science Shows because that's what it is. We go to schools and places and do science shows,
and it's pretty fun. Yeah. And I first saw Mark at TEDx Columbus like 7 years ago, I think now. So, okay. Oh, God, I'm actually right.
It was a very good year.
Actually,
yeah.
right. It's something. I'm going to turn to some calls now. Deborah in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I've been so enjoying. I think I know Mark. Did he ever work the High Li in Columbus?
Yes, he did.
It's a small world.
He was a waiter at the Long Bar for 6 years.
Oh my gosh. I know, but really my question was, I'm such a lover of the praying mantis, and when I first moved in my new house, I put some stink bugs. I know it's terrible, but the praying mantis would eat them.
Yeah, but did you stay in the room? Because it's pretty smelly,
no,
isn't it?
I have like a little like cat thing or a little bug catcher.
I did a movie film of a black widow eating a stink bug one time, and I couldn't stand. I just had to turn the camera on and leave because it smelled so bad.
Okay. Deborah, there's something about an air conditioner in your attic.
A wasp stung the
Yeah, are you there, Deborah? Oh,
we lost her.
Okay.
Well, good shout out to the High Li, though.
Yeah.
Were you here when the High Li was
Deborah.
Around?
Yeah. Heck yeah, I go back that far. Let's see, Jim in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi. I perceive a loss of lightning bugs from 40 years ago when I was a child in suburban Columbus. We used to be able to catch 5 or 6 in a jar. Now, in a similar neighborhood, it's unlikely that I'll see 5 or 6 in a night at the same time. So first question is, are they in decline? And the second question is there any habitat that would promote them the way that people plant milkweed for monarchs?
Hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm thinking about part two while I'm going to answer part one. You're right, and you're not the first person who has mentioned a decline in fireflies. If you go out early in the evening, there is at least one species that still seems fairly common that flies close to the ground and lights up and flies straight up. And it almost sometimes it looks like a fountain coming up from the grass. But overall, there has been a pretty an apparent decline in fireflies. And I don't know if anybody has data on it or not, but I haven't seen any official data on it. Anecdotally, it seems pretty obvious, though, when you go out, it's not like Christmas trees like mm-hmm. it used to. I mean, you used to drive out in the country and it was like Christmas
right,
trees.
Right, over cornfields and stuff like that.
And there are still places where you can do that. And, you know, locally, sometimes they're very common. And it's another kind of thing that, you know, when you were a kid, everything was bigger and your memory expands everything and you think, ooh, there were fireflies everywhere. But there were. I mean, this isn't even just made up. And now there just aren't as many. And so I think fireflies are probably going to be one of the species where data comes out in the near future that shows a longitudinal trend that is showing probably a big, scary decline in them also. Mm-hmm. That said, the glowworms live the babies live in sort of the wet, grassy dirt areas and feed on various things. Some of them feed on snails and other things. And so figuring out how or why the fireflies would be declining is really challenging also without doing a direct study on it and actually, you know, collecting data. I keep saying collecting data, but that's sort of going to be the answer to this whole thing. And how to attract them? I don't know. Give them lots of places to be. Keep mm-hmm. the lights off.
Keep
you know,
light
pollution.
Off.
Light pollution is another big issue with things like fireflies because you can't see each other if there's bright lights all over the place. So
right. And so they just go someplace else where it's dark.
Yeah, or go out in the country and cross your. I don't know. I don't know.
Let's see. Sally in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sally.
Thanks, Ann. I have a question about house centipedes. I live in a condo in Dublin, and the woods are like 10 feet from our back door. We've got like a paver patio, and then there's woods. And ever since we've lived here, I mean, we've always had them, and I mean, I'm just curious where they come from. Like, people make fun of me, but if you look it up on the internet, people say like, oh, they come from the drains, and I really don't believe that. But they're mostly in our basement, but they do come upstairs sometimes, and they freak me out when they do. I'll be honest. I love lightning bugs, and I noticed there were a lot more of them like in the last year. So, anyways, just thought I'd let you know that.
I was gonna say, I think I remember this past summer being kind of not small for lightning, like kind of being a decent lightning bug year too. But overall, it really doesn't seem like it used to, mm-hmm. you know, when we were kids. Where
doesn't seem as long of a season.
Right. And it doesn't seem like there's just the vast numbers
yeah.
of it. And so you know, with insects, they have, you know, a lightning bug can have 400 babies or something. And so they find a little patch of good conditions, and all of a sudden there's a gazillion of them all over the place. But local variations don't necessarily describe the trend. Okay, but about scutes, Scutigeria are those little house centipedes. Mm-hmm. Completely harmless. They will not hurt you. I don't know if that helps or not, but they don't hurt anybody. And they're also predators. And so if they're there, they're only there because they're eating something. And it's usually a result of moisture in the basement. You know, if you're if there's places where the corners get wet or something, it's going to attract little bugs and stuff. And then the centipedes are going to be there to eat them. And really the best way to, if you want to get rid of the centipedes, is figuring out what's attracting them in the first place. And so I'm guessing they're not the only bugs in your basement. But they are one of the only bugs in your basement that you really don't have to worry about that much. Even though they're fast and they creep you out, they don't hurt you and they don't do any damage in your house.
And actually, they kill other bugs.
Stuff that might, like silverfish that will eat wallpaper paste and book binding and stuff like
okay.
that, or you know, baby cockroaches or things like that. They'll eat the other stuff that gets in there, those and spiders. And those little house centipedes, the best thing to do, in my estimation, is to get uncreeped out about them. And if you ever get brave enough to let one walk on your hand, maybe get a kid to do it first and let it run around on your hand, they're really fun and they're really elegant. And when you watch the way they walk around,
yeah.
they're so graceful and beautiful, and they totally can't hurt you. But I think it's cool their name is Scutigeria. So.
Scutigerias. Mm-hmm. They scoot around.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. Anna and Gahanna. You're on the air. Hi, Anna and Gahanna.
Hi. My question is, first, if there's been like a change in like bug cycles and all that, does that mean that mosquitoes are gonna come like sooner? And two, is it bad to kill them? Because
Is it bad to kill? Hey, somebody comes after your blood.
Yeah.
And, you know, I studied mosquitoes during my doctorate research in Massachusetts. And the first day I walked into the lab to interview for the job, Dr. Livdahl, the professor I was working with, took me into the growth chamber, you know, into the environmental chamber where they keep the mosquito populations, and he unbuttoned his shirt.
This is like that Raid commercial, and he stuck his commercial.
Yeah, and he stuck his arm inside, and he said, "This is how we feed our females."
They don't bite. They don't even light.
No, well, no, but they were biting him, and he was like, "This is how we blood feed our females, because they only lay eggs if they blood feed." And so, in order to get stock to work to study, you know, to get samples to study, he would feed them. He'd sit and read a book for 20 minutes and with his arm inside a mosquito cage.
He's not worried about disease or anything like that?
They were lab reared.
Okay,
so they didn't
gotcha.
Pick up diseases anywhere.
Okay.
And so he knew that it was safe. And, you know, you get an allergy to it, but he kind of built up an immunity to it. And he'd kind of go like that and shake them off. And then it didn't bother him at all. But when I went and saw that, I'm like, well, you are feeding my colonies because I'm not going to do that.
Uh-huh.
And it set us off. And it set us off on this effort to try to figure out how to blood feed the females without me sticking my arm in the cage. And it went through different phases. Like one, my lab partner and I had to draw straws to figure out who was going to go to the butcher shop to get the pig's blood. Fresh, you have to have fresh, warm blood, and then who was going to go to the pharmacy to get lambskin condoms to hang in the cages full of blood so that the mosquitoes could feed on it.
Okay.
But it turns out that lambskin condoms, and I honestly did not know this before, are too thick for the mosquitoes to feed
through. They're thicker than our skin.
And apparently thicker than, I don't know anything about any of it. But it didn't work.
Uh-huh.
And so then we had to find other ways to do it. And you can't, I've seen movies of like vampire bats who will go up to a dish of blood and feed from an open dish. Mosquitoes won't do that. They have to pierce a membrane.
Okay.
And so that makes it really challenging. You need fresh, warm blood.
Uh-huh.
Piercing a membrane.
Yeah.
And so we would get little petri dishes and cover them with parafilm, which is like saran wrap, and put them on heat plates and try to get the mosquitoes to feed from there, but it would boil the blood over and we'd have this dry. And so then we would take those things and tape them to the side of screen cages so the mosquitoes could hold onto the cage and feed through, there. And it ended up being like this big, huge effort just to feed mosquitoes. And so can you kill them? Is that the question? Yeah. There's plenty. There's actually a big debate about whether they should be eradicated or not. Like if they should get rid of.
Or where they fit in the food chain kind of a thing.
Yeah. And it's actually controversial because most people think that you take out the major mosquito pests of humans and the ecosystem will find other replacements for them for food and things like
that,
and that they won't miss them that much. But then that's controversial.
Yeah. Anna, thanks for that call. I'm turning now to Courtney in Columbus. Hi, Courtney. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Hi. So I am an urban farmer, I guess, on the east side of Columbus. And I noticed this year is the first year that I've actually had a container garden going, and I have a ton of praying. Is it mantids?
Yeah, mantids. Good.
Well,
been listening to the show.
Yeah.
I have a ton this year, and I have lived in this house, you know, off and on over about 10 years, and I've never noticed them before. I mean, I had so many that they were like flying into my house.
Cool.
Which, very cool. But I was just curious, is it because I have added more plant life, or is there just like an incline in the area? My other question is, what kind of praying mantis species do we have in the area?
Okay.
And then my last thing is my pest problem is slugs. Again, I don't want to kill them, but is there a way that I can manage them? Thanks.
I think people say you can put beer out for slugs.
Oh, slugs, yeah.
That's what I've heard before.
Yeah.
But,
you just move them out of the garden,
So the praying mantises in this part of the country, there are three main species. One is native, two are introduced. And so if you consider them to be big praying mantises, they're probably
the big green kind.
The big green kind.
Yeah.
They can also be brown. like this one. Oops, there's a fly in here. Like that one is a...
Oh, yeah.
That one is an almost adult, I would take it out, but I think it's getting ready to shed, almost adult Chinese mantis. And we've had Chinese mantises here before, and they get really big, and they have a bright green band on the side of their wings. That one doesn't yet because it's not grown up.
Uh-huh.
But
it's big, though.
It is big, and they get really large. And that's the largest mantis around here. And another really big one is called the European mantis, which looks a lot like a Chinese mantis but doesn't have the green band on its wings. But on its legs, on the inside of its front legs, sort of at the elbow joint, it's got a big black spot. So when it goes like this and holds its legs out like that, it looks like a couple big eyes there to scare things away.
And so what you're telling me then, there's a European and a Chinese. These are and not that, native right. originally.
And right. And then there's a native species here called the Carolina mantis, which you would describe more as a medium-sized mantis when it's grown up. And if you have those, it's really good. And if you have the other ones, it may or may not be good. But if you're growing, you said an urban farmer, and I don't know if that means like crops and stuff, but if you're growing a lot of natives, or if you're growing a lot of pollinator flowers, they're going to attract a lot of mantises and spiders too. Mm-hmm. And if you have lights on at night, especially, that's going to attract more because the lights attract bugs and then mantids know it. Mm-hmm. So it's like an eat here sign. And so if you look at things like that, that might explain why you have so many mantises. And all I can say is you're so lucky. You know, there was a big news story this winter about a woman in Vermont who had a Christmas tree and didn't see the praying mantis egg case on it and woke up one day and there were baby praying mantises swarming all over her house. And it made big news all over the networks. But that happens kind of frequently. That you don't even know that they're there. And so maybe there were a couple egg cases around. I'm not sure.
Courtney,
sounds fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that call. We only have time for one more call. And so I'm going to turn to Rodney and kind of put a bookend on this conversation about the decline of bugs. Rodney in Morrow County, you're on the air. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. Well, I live on a 167-acre farm that I bought back in 1973. And I've observed a lot of changes in all sorts of wildlife. Most recently, I have noted the overall decline of insects. One thing that I found very disturbing is the decline in the common orb weaver or garden spider that sets their little webs up to catch flying insects. In 2017, I noticed that the population seemed to be, at least there were fewer of them. And last year, 2018, there were none.
But what do you make of that, Mark Berman? We're just about out of time.
And,
but
I mean, you're looking at them in the same place over time, and those are important. That's, I mean, those are observations, but that's the kind of important sort of data that you would want to get. A few years ago, I went on a date, a first date with a woman, and I said, I want to take you where the living is easy. And we went to to this park along this path where you look over to the side and there were orb weavers everywhere.
Yeah.
And they were there because the living was easy. And I don't think she was that impressed, but that's a different story. But I will not challenge what you're saying. You're right. And if there's no flying bugs,
there's not going to be anything to catch them.
And
right.
So that is just more evidence of what's likely happening. And maybe next time we're here, we'll have a chance to have more actual firm observations and data on it. But right now, it's just sort of those two big studies, one from Puerto Rico and one from Germany, that are saying that there's really, really something serious going on. So now everybody who's out there in the fields looking around, pay attention to what you see and what you don't see. And, you know, you can
maybe
keep the conversation going. Not that there's anything we can do about it.
Mark Berman, entomologist and founder of Bugman Education and Science Shows. Thanks for joining us today.
It's really fun. Thank you.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.